It's okay. I need two. Only need two. Right, Cabinet today approved a response to the Foreign Affairs and Defence Select Committee report on Taiwan's observership at the WHO. That will be put into Parliament next week. Approves the submission of an order in council on the future of the Christchurch and Dunedin Colleges of Education, which are merging with their local universities. We're well on the process to getting three bills which have been developed by the Law Commission in the past, introduced by the end of August. That's the arbitration amendment, a bill on wills, and a bill called the Succession Homicide Bill. We have, with respect to the Defence Force deployment in Timor, agreed to maintain it at up to the current numbers, which is around 207. Some drawdown is likely in the coming months, and we will review again formally by the end of September. The monthly cost of this deployment is running at about 2.2 million. So the UN force, which picked up part of that, would be very welcome. We have agreed to improve the criteria around the mortgage insurance scheme operated through Housing New Zealand. Chris Carter will have an announcement to make about that. And we have also agreed to the release of a discussion document on a review of standards and conformance infrastructure. That is a subject Leanne is going to be making an announcement about tomorrow night. We have finalised a discussion document on the tertiary education strategy for the next 5 years, 07 to 12, and on draft of the statement of tertiary education priorities, which the sector works to within that strategy. And also next week, we're expecting Michael Cullen to outline a new agenda around international education. That's both attracting international students to here and also the extent to which we support our own institutions and students linking offshore. We have dealt with papers from Judith Tizard and Associate Commerce Capacity on the question of New Zealand access to international trademark treaties. There's the Singapore Treaty on the Law of Trademarks and the Madrid Protocol and the Nice Agreement. There's been discussion document and consultation about that, and we're moving towards signature and the treaty examination process. Judith Tizard will no doubt release more details. The Minister of Revenue will have an announcement to make around a new double tax agreement with Austria. And I have the terminus is here today to talk about government policy statements on something else, which I'll come to in a moment. Coming up this week, we are expecting the major figures out on employment. I think the stats on the quarterly employment survey were out today. The Household Labour Force survey will be out on Tuesday. Tomorrow we have an all-day caucus at Premier House. Tomorrow also the Ministry of Social Development will be releasing the Social Report 2006, which is the latest statistics against the range of indicators we've been measuring for the last 5 or 6 years. Phil Goff will also have an announcement about the future of the wreck of the HMNZS Canterbury, which has gone out of commission. Mark Burton will be in Blenheim for signing terms of negotiation for another treaty settlement with an iwi in the top of the South Island. On the situation in Lebanon, it's obviously been extremely well covered by local and international media. I think the resolution which has been drafted for the Security Council is not without its problems. It doesn't call for an immediate cessation of hostilities. It calls for a cessation of attacks or offensive action, which allows the prospect of future hostilities from both sides based on the concept of self-defence. To be effective, of course, such a resolution has to be accepted and implemented by both Israel and Lebanon, and that outlook remains uncertain as we speak. There's also some question as to the nature of the resolution which would follow the first resolution. That is, what kind of international force does it build on the existing UN interim force in Lebanon? Is it a new force? Is it restricted to South Lebanon? Does it range more widely? Those are all still issues which the Security Council has yet to grapple with fully. So, sad to say, a month after this conflict began, it is still not presenting with resolution in sight. Now, I've asked Mr. Parker and Leanne Dalziel to come down and talk about the two government policy statements around encouraging investment in electricity infrastructure, which the Cabinet has agreed on. David.
Thank you. You should already have a copy of the release which attaches a revised copy or a revised version of the government policy statement through which the government expresses its wishes to the Electricity Commission. There are six main themes to the amendments, all of which are meant to emphasise the strategic importance which the government attaches to timely investment in the transmission grid. The six main points are, firstly, we wanted to emphasise the importance of adequate transmission, including its ability to cope with extreme events. We also wanted to better provide for diversity of supply routes, especially for major cities. The reason for that is that if you do have, there remains a risk that you'll have an untoward event or set of events which can take out a major substation, as we found with Otahuhu earlier in winter. And when that happens, we would like to have alternative routes to direct power into Auckland so that you either avoid a blackout completely or you can restore power a lot more quickly than occurred this year. Thirdly, we want to ensure that the grid facilitates competition in generation and retail by minimising transmission constraints. The government's of the view that the grid is an essential prerequisite to effective competition in both retail and generation. If there are transmission constraints, then the generators of electricity who sit within an area between which there are, inside an area, have an advantage because those who want to compete against them from a more distant point have trouble getting their power into market. So if you have those sorts of transmission constraints, then you have less effective competition and therefore the potential at least for the generators that are local to extract some form of monopoly rent from consumers. That can be avoided through a strong grid which facilitates the transfer of power from more distant points. Fourthly, we want to ensure that transmission planning supports the government's goals of facilitating renewable energy and reducing greenhouse gases. Most sources of renewable energy are significantly distanced from cities. So if you want to have a renewable energy future, you have to have a strong grid in order to deliver the electricity from those distant places of generation to the cities where much of it is consumed. The next point that we make is that to the extent possible, we want grid upgrade plans, which is the term that's given to plans that Transpower has to upgrade the grid. We want them to express a strategic vision for what they want for the whole of New Zealand, and for individual plans to be consistent with that strategy. We want to avoid the risk that we'll take little piecemeal decisions that won't result in the best overall outcome. And lastly, we want to ensure that Transpower can recover the reasonable costs of acquiring land corridors in advance of approval of the detail of the upgrades that might sit on the land corridors they acquire. The reason for that is that these processes do take a long time for the relevant people to be properly consulted. Obviously, we need to give local people the opportunity to object to specific proposals or for other people to come up with what might be better, more cost-effective or more environmentally friendly alternatives. But we also have to have regard to the fact that eventually sometimes we face deadlines by which we need to build things. And one of the ways that we can ensure that we don't leave those margins too tight is to give Transpower the authority to build, to buy corridors in advance of the date when they've got certainty as to what exactly it is that they will put on the corridor or the date by which they will need to put it on. So those are the main points in the government policy statement. And
do your one.
Do you want to?
I'll just speak briefly about my the one that I will be signing off under Section 26 of the Commerce Act. The reason for that is that Part 4A of the Act, which is delegated to the Minister of Energy, comes within the Minister of Energy's jurisdiction in all respects except for the transmission of a government policy statement. The importance of the government policy statement that we're announcing today under Section 26 of the Commerce Act reinforces the fact that our Commerce Commission is a competition authority. Its role is to ensure that there are processes put in place, that when control is put in place, that in fact it is done so for the benefit of consumers. But when we have some of our regulated companies working in the area of infrastructure, we know that security of supply, for example, in the electricity sector, as David's already said, is of paramount importance. So what the government's doing today is reconfirming the fact that consumers of regulated businesses should not be disadvantaged by the investments of regulated businesses in other infrastructure and services, that regulated businesses are held accountable for making investments in that business where those investments have been provided for in regulated revenues and prices, and that's really important, where individual companies have in fact promised that they will undertake investment, that they do follow through on that, and that regulated businesses provide infrastructure at the quality required by consumers at an efficient price. But in return for that, I think what the government really wants to reinforce is that our view is that the investment in replacement, upgraded and new infrastructure and in related businesses for the long-term benefit of consumers must be protected as well. And that's why this government policy statement will be issued. And that we believe as a government that this will be achieved by regulatory stability, transparency and certainty, giving businesses the confidence to make long life investments, regulated rates of return being commercially realistic and taking full account of the long-term risks to consumers of underinvestment in basic infrastructure, and regulated businesses being confident that they will not be disadvantaged in their regulated businesses if they invest in other infrastructure and services. So that is the intent of the government policy statement that I will be issuing.
Any questions on the government policy statements on electricity?
Mr. Parker, is there an implicit criticism of the way the Electricity Commission has been approaching transmission decisions?
No, there's not. The Electricity Commission has done a very good job since its establishment on a lot of fronts. We have run into a bit of a snafu on the Waikato upgrade, but I don't blame the Electricity Commission for it. Neither do I absolve either they or Transpower from responsibility for sorting it out. And so the government has chosen to make its expectations clear to the Electricity Commission, but we will be similarly making it clear to Transpower.
So could you explain what your fifth bullet point means for the Waikato upgrade? I mean, I presume it's the one that pertains. What are you telling the Commission to do when you say take a longer term view?
Well, we're telling the I'll go back a step. Transpower has already been acquiring significant amounts of land through the Waikato because just about everyone agrees that at some stage in the future an additional corridor into Auckland is needed. The controversy has been about when it's needed by and what its shape should be. Until now, Transpower hasn't been able to recover the cost of those land purchases because they have been tied up with the approval to what goes on the land corridor. And we're now saying, look, we need to separate those two decisions because it's not fair that Transpower's not getting a return on what it is prudently doing, which is acquiring a land corridor.
I get that. That's point six. Point five is the one about grid upgrade planning should be comprehensive and considered in the context of long-term plans. I mean, wasn't that part of the debate over the Waikato line, that it was a debate about whether we should do some fixing now and leave some of the upgrade for 400 kV for later?
Yes, in part, but one of the criticisms that has been made is that Transpower hasn't clearly articulated its long-term vision for the whole of the grid, or the main parts of the grid, from, say, Benmore through to Auckland. And there has been proper focus on Waikato, but when you're considering whether there is a need to upgrade to 400 kV in the Waikato region, it's relevant also whether that's part of a long-term vision that has 400 kV as the main backbone throughout New Zealand.
Can you just, perhaps just in plain English, describe to us precisely what the government is trying to do with all this? I mean, if I'm a consumer, what is all this going to mean to me?
We're emphasising to the regulators that the prime concern that the government has is that the lights don't go out. Security of supply is the paramount consideration.
Does that mean with the words that Mr. Dalzell was saying, that we're being told in a roundabout way that we may have to accept higher prices in order to achieve that aim?
Marginally so. I don't think the amounts that we're talking about at the margin would cause a large increase in prices. But it is true that if instead of having one major substation at Otahuhu leading into Auckland, we need two, that there is a cost to having two instead of one. And that cost would flow through in electricity prices.
So what does the Commerce Commission have to do? What does it have to swallow in order to allow that to happen? I couldn't quite understand in the gaming between the two of you.
The Commerce Commission doesn't have to swallow anything, really, in that context. One of the things we have asked outside of these two statements for the Electricity Commission and the Commerce Commission to clarify is between themselves is how Transpower automatically gets paid for things that the Electricity Commission approves, because at the moment it seems to be a two-step process, which is a little bit... more difficult than should be necessary.
Do these statements make anything happen? Or is it now up to the Electricity Commission? It says here to give effect to the statement.
Yes, the decisions as to which upgrades, if any, are approved to the grid are at law decisions for the Electricity Commission, not for the government. What we do is we emphasise the importance of making those decisions, which we have done through this statement.
So in simple terms, the debate that occurred over the last few months of last year, where the Electricity Commission says, yes, you can go ahead and build it, and the Commerce Commission says, well, you can't recover the price to pay for it, that will be prevented by what you've done today.
That actually hasn't been the main problem in the last year. The main problem in the last year has been disagreements between Transpower and the Electricity Commission as to what should be built.
So that's still an issue, though, wasn't it? The one I've just outlined.
I don't think it has been as pressing an issue as it has been perhaps presented. I think the more important issue is getting clarity as to what should be built when. And I think the Commerce Commission is aware that if Transpower has to spend significant money on an upgrade, then they need to be paid for it.
Has this statement been in place at the time that the Electricity Commission considered the Waikato lines? Do you think that the Waikato lines would have been approved?
I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that. I think this new government policy statement is informed not by just what's been happening in the Waikato, but also the problems that we've had in Auckland this winter. So particularly the emphasis that we put on the need for diversity of supply routes and the ability of the grid to cope with extreme events are informed by what happened in Auckland this winter rather than what happened in the Waikato.
So
would
you come out the strongest statement?
It's a delicate line that you tread. These decisions are for the Electricity Commission, and it's not for us to devil too much in the detail as to what particular decision they could make. We just need to make it clear of the priority that we give to the paramount importance of security of supply.
Would it be right to describe these as a new set of rules, or are they guidelines?
The
different answer for the two commissions. For me, for the Commerce Commission, they have to take into account government policy, but they don't have to follow the government policy. And I think that's why it's been structured in the way that it has. It simply reinforces their role as the competition authority, but says what the government's priorities are. I should say, though, that I've already signalled a review of Part 4 of the Commerce Act, and I think you can take that from the GPS that we've announced today, that indeed the terms of reference, which I'll be releasing in the very near future, will include a consideration of whether the law itself needs to be amended.
And in respect of the government policy statement to the Electricity Commission, it is more directive. The Electricity Commission is required to give effect to the statement rather than have regard to it.
And under those 4A delegations to the Minister of Energy, does that mean we can see an opening up of the ability to invest across generation lines and retail at a later date if there's a decision on that?
That is a separate issue, but it's one of the issues that will be dealt with this year under the New Zealand Energy Strategy. And the submissions that have been made by, for example, the smaller distributed lines companies in the regions as to why they should be freer to generate or retail are already public, but we've not yet made our final decision on that point.
So security of supply is the paramount thing you want, then what does that indicate about what you might do about distributed energy?
Could you rephrase that question?
Well, if the driving thing of this is to have security of supply, and you're talking here about distributed energy, what retail and power companies can do, and whether there can be more investment by companies.
If we weren't going to have a secure supply of energy without permitting local lines companies to generate and retail, we would do that because our paramount objective is security of supply. Having said that, it's not 100% clear that that is a necessary step to ensure security of supply.
Are you essentially knocking some heads together here among the various regulatory authorities and saying this current system is not good enough, we're not moving to the system we want fast enough, and you guys sort it out?
There's a little bit of that in it. I think it's, as I said earlier, it's informed by the problems that we've had in Auckland this year, and those problems aren't to be laid at the foot of the Electricity Commission. They haven't caused them. But it is, you know, it's public knowledge that there have been some difficult relationships between the Electricity Commission and Transpower, and we're making it absolutely clear to them that it's their responsibility to ensure that those problems don't unnecessarily delay decisions and put at threat security of supply, which, as I've said, is our paramount concern.
David, just on the subject of those difficult relationships, I understand Mr. Hemingway's contract is up for renewal in September. Could you give us any indication of your thinking in terms of whether that contract will be renewed?
Both in respect of the Electricity Commission and Transpower, there's a regular turnover of appointments. It's true that there are members of both Transpower and the Electricity Commission whose terms come up this year. Whether we reappoint and who we appoint will be considered at that time.
So just to recap after a good lot of questions, what is driving this is a desire to get security of supply. In the time I've been Prime Minister, we've experienced within a 3-year period two 100-year dries, we were told, which put great pressure on supply. We've experienced this fault of Otahuhu, which very much exposed the reliance on a single point of entry for power to Auckland. And only in relatively recent weeks, we experienced what I think is called the National Grid Emergency, where firing everything up wasn't quite enough. And that concerns us greatly as a government. When we set up the Electricity Commission, what we had in mind was that they would always manage for a margin to ensure security of supply. And nothing is more important to a modern economy and society than the power being on. So this is about backing investment to get that. Note the emphasis in the policy statement from Mr. Parker on renewables. Transmission upgrades are very much linked to that. distributed generation close into where demand is will almost inevitably be thermal and could commit the country to a very expensive future as well. That's not the sort of future we're looking to. We are seeing reliance on renewables as very, very important indeed. So these are important statements, and they do give very clear guidance, I believe, to the regulators about what the government's expectations are. Right, any other questions?
Prime Minister, can you attend to what is the party intend to follow Nationals lead and repay any money identified by the Attorney General as missing power which refuses this government?
Well, firstly, I find that various letters from parliamentary services came into my office last week with opinions from the Solicitor General which have only caught up with the fact they were received today, and I haven't had time to fully appraise myself of the details of what was contained in that. But the clear impression I have gained, as have other ministers I've been talking to, and the clear impression clearly that other parties have gained, going by the media reports, is that these opinions appear to overturn long-standing practice in expenditure of parliamentary party budgets. Now, everyone is very happy to take guidance for the future, but if parties have been spending in accordance with parliamentary service rules and having that expenditure authorised by parliamentary services, then it is exactly as Peter Brown of New Zealand First has said, a bit like someone coming along and wanting to change the rules of the game after the ref has blown the final whistle. And that appears to be the position that parties across the board are being placed in, not just with respect to this election, but actually going back many years, and also taking into account that the Solicitor General's opinion tends to imply that he's not just interested in the three-month period, but more generally.
So it
will be raising a number of implications. I'm not aware that anybody's been asked to pay anything back at this point. What I'm saying is that these opinions tend to be leading to overturning long-standing practice and authorisation by parliamentary service of spending.
Perhaps it's been incorrect in the past, and I mean, on the comments from the Auditor General and the Solicitor General, the pledge card would have seemed to have breached the rules.
I think you're wrong to focus on that. These opinions have implications for spending over many years and right through the electoral cycle, the whole three-year period. That is why I say they appear to be a challenge to long-standing practice by parliamentary parties. And indeed, if you took a strict reading of some of what appears to be coming through in these opinions, you would find it hard-pressed to see what you could spend on at all. For example, you'll be aware that many members of parliament issue a newsletter, an MP's reports. It seems to be that kind of document as well that is being pointed to as an improper use of money. And yet this is a very long-standing practice. So this will have to be carefully looked at for the overall implications. But I repeat, totally in agreement with New Zealand First, that to try to change the rules after the final whistles have been blown is not appropriate.
So if you would challenge a finding, even if the Crown card was clearly...
I don't think you should focus on one item of spending.
But this ruling... What I'm saying to you is
that every year parliamentary parties get allocated budgets. Individual MPs get allocated budgets. The direction these rulings are going in looks to challenge the practice on which spending has occurred and been authorised over many, many years.
How do you challenge that?
We haven't yet, of course, got a report. We've got opinions, we've got provisional ideas being put forward. There is no final report to respond to at this point.
There was a statement in the draft report about the amount of material, and I'm not talking about Labour, but across the whole range of parties, but with the general season, he seems quite surprised and actually disappointed in parliamentary services handling of that. Do you think that aspect maybe needs to be cleared up in terms of the clarity of the rules, or do you think we're just taking it too far?
Well, I think things are being taken much too far. the whole idea with the development of the parliamentary party budgets was that parties could promote their policies. That meant government parties could promote their policies, and presumably opposition parties could promote their policies attacking them. Now, if a very narrow view is to be taken of that, that somehow some political advantage might be gained from someone promoting their policies, then quite frankly, apart from printing a calling card, it's very hard to see what you could do with the money.
But if you can't take advice with the Auditor General and the Solicitor General, who will you, or who can you take direction from in terms of what the rules are supposed to be?
Well, I think the rules will need to be written so that the long-standing practice of being able to promote policy through communications by members of Parliament and parliamentary parties can be upheld. Certainly it needs to be made clear that the practice of communicating policy through these budgets is a proper one.
And is that done through law change?
Well, look, we'd have to take advice on that. As I say, we don't have a final report to respond to at this point.
Is there such ambiguity that a reappraisal is necessary, and who should conduct that?
Well, obviously the opinion of the Solicitor General, the former Solicitor General, will be studied. The views of the Auditor General will be studied. There'll need to be some consultation across parties, and I think that's already been going on at a staff level as to the way forward. But I think we have to focus on the way forward, because I cannot emphasise enough that these opinions appear to run contrary to very long-standing practice.
But isn't it? You can just stretch the rules year after year, and suddenly people with no self-interest have said enough is enough.
No, I don't believe that's the case, because expenditure is authorised by parliamentary service. Parliamentary service, of course, has always been mindful that you have to allow parties to innovate in what they do. Some parties, for example, have paid for full billboards. Others have used bus shelters. Some get fridge magnets printed. All those things have been seen as legitimate by parliamentary services by way of promoting policy. Now, the rules will have to be looked at for the future, because nobody sets out to spend money inappropriately. People send out to spend money which has authorisation from parliamentary service.
Do you think parliamentary service has been dumped in it somewhat, given that a lot of the parties are saying, well, we came back and checked with them, and the rules seem to have been accepted of, maybe both sides, parliamentary service and the party?
I think parliamentary service, like the parties, has acted in good faith in applying the rules around expenditure as it understood them. And so if there's a misunderstanding this fundamental, then something needs to be done moving forward.
Actually, the Auditor General found that parliamentary service reimbursed spending for explicit ads soliciting votes last election from a number of parties, and criticised parliamentary service for that.
Well, I haven't got into the detail of that. I couldn't even comment on that. But where the parliamentary service guidelines have been observed, and where the Solicitor General and the Auditor General take a different view, then clearly you have to have some review of how to move forward.
So when you give an undertaking that you will accept the Auditor General's recommendations on this issue?
Well, I'm not going to really commit to recommendations when they haven't been made. Obviously, anything that the Auditor General puts out is studied very seriously, so opinions by the Solicitor General. But it very much looks like Parliament is left with a practical problem, and that is that a great deal, if not the great majority, of what parliamentary parties have spent their funding on for many years may be deemed to have been inappropriate, and clearly the situation can't rest there.
What are your options if the Auditor General notifies the Speaker that there's been a breach of appropriation?
Well, I think we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Would you consider retrospective legislation?
I think we'll consider what options are available when we see what course of action is being proposed.
What's the situation with Winston Peters? Have you seen him yet?
I understand Winston Peters is home, and I understand he intends to be in at work in the next couple of days.
Do you know if the spots have gone away?
I have no idea. No sighting has been registered.
Prime Minister, can you clarify your opening comment about Taiwan and the WHO? Has there been a change of government policy?
No, there hasn't. There was a petition that was brought to Parliament. Taiwan has been advocating for a rather greater status at the WHO, but the government's response is to uphold existing policy, which is to back the way the WHO has handled the matter, which is to have practical working arrangements with Taiwan, which is very important when you're trying to deal with issues like a pandemic of avian flu. So we're satisfied there's practical arrangements in place which don't require a change to Taiwan's status.
But you're still opposing Taiwan's membership?
Oh, absolutely. It would be inconsistent with the One China policy, which most nations around the world adhere to.
Are you expecting Tauranga Field and the Ingram Report to be discussed at tomorrow's All-Day Caucus?
No.
There aren't any concerns from MPs, backbenchers that want to discuss the way the situation is
played out? Absolutely none that I'm aware of.
Are you 100% confident that he cooperated with that inquiry fully and he didn't do anything to frustrate the Ingram inquiry?
Well, Dr. Ingram himself recorded that he had the full cooperation of Mr. Field.
He said he had the full cooperation in respect of Mr. Field making himself available to be interviewed.
And supplying documents and so on.
Yes, but are you confident that he did nothing to frustrate the inquiry?
Well, I can only go by what the inquiry found, which is that Mr. Field had cooperated with the inquiry.
The caucus or the Labour Party go to censure Mr. Field or take any other action against him?
I think Mr. Field is well aware of the disappointment of colleagues, but people have undertaken to work with him to try and get his practices in better order. That's why the Chief Whip, Mr. Barnett, was up in his elected office Saturday last week running through those issues.
But why would you be prepared to censure him as part of a parliamentary motion but not as a party?
I think we've made our views very clear. I have to repeat for the record that Mr. Field has suffered severe punishment. He is no longer a minister. He was not reinstated as a minister. He has suffered public humiliation. He has had to acknowledge that his work practices needed to be changed, and he has offered Parliament an apology. Now, short of tying a piece of bungee rope around his ankles and throwing off the ninth floor, I'm not clear what else could be done.
You say he's aware of the disappointment of his colleagues. Does that suggest this has been discussed in caucus previously?
Well, of course it does, because every week, as leader of the Labour Party, I give a report to the caucus. I discuss how things are being handled. Of course this matter has been discussed. And I have had nothing but praise for the way it's been handled.
What about for Mr. Field? Was there criticism of Mr. Field during
People this? Are disappointed of what was revealed in the report because of the reasons that I have made plain from day one. And I did read this report 3 weeks ago. Some may not have, but I did. From day one, I have said that there were not proper boundaries observed between personal interests and friendships on the one hand and the professionalism expected of a Member of Parliament on the other. Those are issues of judgment, they're serious issues of judgment, they're errors of judgment, and that is what has stood in the way of reinstatement as a Minister, which is a very severe penalty.
Do you expect him to be standing for Labour next election?
I don't know what his decision about standing for re-election would be, but if he decides to stand for re-election, I would be pretty certain he'd be putting his hand up for the Labour Party.
So why is Labour prepared to censure him as part of a parliamentary motion and not censure him as a member of
the
party?
It's a very rare practice to pass such a motion. I can only think of one occasion in recent years where Mr. Tamahiri mounted a full-scale assault on the integrity of the Parliamentary Labour Party, and that was dealt with. Apart from that, we often express our disappointment with the way people handle things.
But this is also a very rare circumstance.
Well, it's disappointing, as I said, but that disappointment has been fully communicated.
The Māori Party is saying today, with the electoral option results being back, that Labour was
going around and encouraging supporters to switch from the Māori to the general role because they've given up on winning those seats back, and also to help get back some of the seats they lost last time around. Have you got any comments on that?
Well, I know of absolutely no evidence for that whatsoever. It's a very wild and loose statement. The Labour stood right back in line with our policy of allowing people to choose. You know, some people made the choice to move from general to Māori, others made the choice to move from Māori to general, and a whole lot more people enrolled for the first time. And that, I think, is a good outcome to get that level of new enrolments.
Have you had a reason at all on whether it's likely that the numbers will mean the next
to Māori? No, I think it's too early to say.
Just on the Ross Robertson's code of conduct, the National have said it's a diversion. Do you accept that?
No, of course not. Ross's timing, as you know, was quite independent of anything else that was going on. And he had an appointment with the Standing Orders Committee to go and discuss his code of conduct. That certainly wasn't any carefully laid plan of the Labour caucus. It's something Ross Robertson's felt strongly about for many years. He got to have his hearing. No doubt in due course we'll have the Standing Orders Committee come back and report to the caucus on what the range of views is. I note that the last thing the National Party wants is a code of conduct. I said in this room last week that I had an open mind on it.
Yeah, when after the Donna Awatere debacle you were strongly supportive of one, I just wondered...
I've got an open mind on it, but really it's up to Standing Orders Committee now, having heard Ross Robertson's submission, to send the members back to their caucuses to see where they'd like the committee to go. It's something that would need to be developed up through a committee like Standing Orders.
But would the value of it be that Parliament itself would be able to exercise some oversight over these sorts of matters, or because you think MPs actually need rules to guide them in their efforts?
Well, rules in themselves are not a bad thing. Guidelines are not a bad thing, and they would enable people to be held to account against them. It is new territory for Parliament. Parliament has only, up until now, had rules governing the conduct of members within Parliament. Conduct outside Parliament is new territory, and that's why you would want to look at overseas precedents. I know the British have moved somewhat in this direction. I'm not aware of how other parliaments handle it.